I want you to close your eyes for just a second, right where you are, and picture the Revolutionary War.
Oh, I think I know where this is going.
Right. Because if you are like most of us, there is a very specific mental movie reel that starts playing almost immediately in your head.
Yeah, it's usually that classic, really romanticized reel, like a heroic 19th century oil painting brought to life.
Exactly. You are seeing these stoic generals sitting perfectly upright on beautiful white horses, gazing out over this pristine valley.
And, you know, the uniforms are immaculate.
Yes. Brilliantly colored red and blue coats. You see perfectly straight lines of troops marching across a green field.
Maybe there's a solitary fife and drum playing nobly in the background.
Right. It's clean, it's orderly. But for today's deep dive, my mission is to ask you to take that sanitized greatest hits movie reel and just throw it completely out the window.
Because that's really just a comforting piece of mythology painted over actual history.
Totally. We are going to uncover the brutal, gritty reality and the invisible infrastructure that actually kept this entire conflict going.
Which is fascinating because the reality of that conflict was fundamentally different from the paintings we grew up looking at.
It really was. And to do that, we have to start with a jaw-dropping statistic that forces a complete reorientation of how you view military history.
Oh, the mortality rates.
Yeah. If you were dropped into the middle of the Revolutionary War, the British Army would actually be the least of your problems.
Which sounds crazy to say.
It does. But you were actually 9 times more likely to be killed by microscopic bacteria than you were by an enemy's musket.
A 9-to-1 death ratio completely shifts the paradigm of the war. I mean, it means the overarching conflict wasn't primarily fought on those pristine battlefields with artillery and brilliant cavalry charges.
No, not at all. It was fought in the mud, in the tents, and, well, in the bloodstreams of the soldiers.
Which is a horrifying image, honestly.
It is. And to explore that muddy, invisible reality, we are pulling from a truly remarkable foundational source today.
Yeah, it's a 2-volume collection called My Patriot Story.
Compiled by the Blue Ridge chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR.
And what makes this source so captivating is that it completely ignores the standard, dry, textbook approach.
Right. There is no high-level military strategy here. You won't find sweeping troop movements plotted on a map.
Bypassing the generals to focus on those personal records gives us the hidden war.
Exactly. The DAR built this flesh-and-blood view from the ground up, using raw research, old family Bibles, personal letters, and centuries of oral traditions.
We get to see the specific people who actually had to endure the physical reality of that 9-to-1 death ratio day in and day out.
So to understand how that terrifying ratio even came to be, we have to look at the people tasked with fighting that invisible microscopic enemy on the front lines.
Which brings us to Richard Waters.
Yes, in the DAR collection, there is the story of this man, Richard Waters. He served as an assistant surgeon in the Maryland line under William Smallwood's division.
And when you look at the sheer volume of the DAR records, something truly alarming jumps out regarding Richard Waters.
What's that?
In this massive, multi-volume collection of Revolutionary War history, Waters is the only medical officer detailed.
Wow, the only one.
The only one. The Continental Army simply did not have the medical infrastructure to support its troops.
That is wild.
They were gathering thousands of men from totally disparate regions, packing them into camps, and they were essentially flying blind biologically. It highlights a complete logistical failure.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we hear the title assistant surgeon, and our modern brains instantly default to the modern surgical
Oh,
field.
for sure, like an episode of Grey's Anatomy.
Right. We picture crisp scrubs, bright overhead lights, a sterile, isolated environment with a team handing each other perfectly clean, shining instruments.
But we are talking about a pre-germ theory world here.
Exactly. There are no antibiotics. There is zero sterilization. There isn't even anesthesia.
If you were lucky, you got a hard pull of whiskey and a leather strip to bite down on.
Just imagine the visceral horror of Richard Waters' daily life. He is wading through thick, freezing mud in a heavily blood-stained leather apron.
Because nobody understands what bacteria even is, the standard practice was to wipe unsterilized surgical blades directly on your own breeches before moving right to the next screaming patient.
It's like an agricultural slaughterhouse, not a hospital.
It really is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, The sheer volume of trauma surgery, like the amputations, the musket ball removals, wasn't even his primary enemy.
Right. The DAR notes say his relentless daily battle was against what they broadly categorized as camp fever,
which meant massive, sweeping outbreaks of typhus and dysentery.
And to understand why a lone surgeon was so overwhelmed, you have to look at the mechanisms of how these diseases functioned in that specific environment. Typhus, for instance, is spread by body lice.
Yeah, and how do you even begin to control an outbreak of body lice in a military camp in the 1770s?
I mean, you really don't, right?
You don't. The soldiers lived day and night in damp wool uniforms. They rarely had a change of clothes.
So that damp wool essentially became a mobile incubator for the lice.
Exactly. The insects thrived in the seams of the fabric, constantly biting the men, worn for months on end through freezing winters.
And then add to that the outbreaks of dysentery. That tore through the camps for a tragically simple reason.
The latrines.
Right. The latrines were almost always dug too close to the drinking water sources.
Because there was absolutely no understanding of waterborne pathogens or how the water table functioned.
Waters was fighting these colossal, invisible outbreaks with zero scientific tools. His only real option was isolation.
Which is physically impossible in a crowded, muddy encampment.
Yet, against all biological odds, Richard Waters somehow survived.
It really is a miracle.
It's baffling. He was surrounded by the most legal forces on the continent, performing butchery in the mud with no protective gear, and he made it out alive.
He even married Margaret Hamilton Smith in 1785, had 13 children, and lived until 1810.
A true testament to human resilience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thinking about how fast disease spread in those open-air camps leads us to a much darker reality regarding the infrastructure of the war.
Yeah, because if an open-air encampment was that lethal, the environment becomes exponentially more deadly when those soldiers are forced into confined spaces.
Spaces where they literally cannot escape the pathogens.
Exactly.
Which brings me to the POW camps. When I picture a military prison, I immediately picture static buildings, you know, stone walls, iron bars, maybe a fortress.
Sure, that's the standard image.
So why on earth were the British holding American POWs on rotting boats? It seems like such an overly complicated and bizarre logistical choice.
Well, it was a massive logistical nightmare born entirely out of desperation.
Desperation out.
The British controlled the coastal cities, like New York and Charleston, but they severely lacked the inland infrastructure, the territorial control, and the massive manpower required to build and secure huge inland prisons.
So they couldn't safely march thousands of prisoners into the interior without risking ambush.
Right. So they had to improvise with what they had right there in the harbors.
And what they had were decommissioned ships.
Exactly.
The DAR records give us a harrowing account of this from a man named William Bransford. He was a patriot who rode in Light Horse Harry Lee's cavalry.
Captured in 1780, right?
Yeah. And he was held on a decommissioned prison schooner called the Pack Horse, anchored in Charleston Harbor. The sensory reality of this is just unimaginably horrific.
Because the British would strip the masts off these ships, gut the interiors, and just pack them with captured soldiers. They earned the nickname floating coffins for a reason.
Just imagine being shoved below decks into the belly of a wooden hull with hundreds of other men. There are no portholes. There is zero ventilation.
And the temperature extremes would have been brutal.
Totally. In the winter, you are dealing with a freezing, damp coastal chill that settles deep into your bones. In the summer, the Charleston heat turns that sealed wooden hull into a literal kiln.
All while being completely surrounded by human waste, sweat, and rampant disease.
The environment was almost physically designed to break the human body and spirit.
But Bransford did survive. Amazingly.
He did. He made it out and was eventually rewarded with 200 acres of bounty land in Ohio.
The DAR source, however, is very careful to contrast his incredible survival story with the much more common, much darker reality of captivity.
Right. The tragedy of Anthony Taylor and his son-in-law, Aaron Powell, serves as a grim counterpoint.
They were captured together in Sudbury.
But instead of a prison ship, they were sent to a static land prison in Portsmouth.
And I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, I would assume a building on land would offer at least slightly better conditions than a rotting hull in a harbor.
Unfortunately, the conditions proved to be just as lethal, if not more so, because of the specific biology of the space.
The smallpox.
Yes. While trapped in that Portsmouth prison, Anthony Taylor contracted smallpox. And smallpox, in a static, overcrowded prison, was an absolute death sentence.
Because you have highly contagious airborne variola virus circulating among malnourished men with severely weakened immune systems.
They are breathing completely stagnant air in incredibly close quarters with no possibility of quarantine.
It's just a nightmare. Taylor slowly rotted in captivity, eventually dying right next to his son-in-law.
And this raises an important question about the psychological toll on the survivors.
The psychological weight of that on Aaron Powell is just staggering to consider.
Because Powell miraculously manages to escape the prison after Taylor dies.
Right, and he then has to navigate his way through hostile territory just to get back home, knowing exactly the devastating news he's carrying.
He has to walk through his front door, look his wife in the eye, and tell her that her father is dead.
The profound cruelty of that moment is that he is completely robbed of giving her a heroic battlefield narrative.
He can't offer her the comfort of saying her father died bravely leading a charge or defending a hill.
No. He has to admit that he watched her father waste away in the squalor of a filthy cell, killed by an invisible virus.
It strips all the perceived glory out of the conflict, doesn't it?
It really does. Mm. Now, the British obviously struggled immensely with holding prisoners. But did the Patriots face this same logistical nightmare?
Well, they faced the exact inverse of the British problem.
Meaning what?
The Patriots couldn't keep thousands of prisoners in the coastal cities they controlled because those areas were highly vulnerable to British naval rescue operations.
Oh, because the British Navy could just sail in and liberate them.
Exactly. So the Patriots were forced to march their captives deep inland, far away from the coast.
Which brings us to the infamous Convention Army and a Patriot militia private named Jacob Carwiles.
Right. The Convention Army was made up of the thousands of British and Hessian troops who surrendered at the massive Battle of Saratoga in 1777.
And the Patriots marched them deep into the Virginia wilderness.
Ultimately, to the freezing Albemarle Barracks, where Private Carwiles was assigned to stand guard over them.
Okay, I'm stopping you right there, because this makes zero sense to me.
I know, it sounds crazy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Wasn't the original Saratoga Convention a signed, formal agreement to put those surrendered troops on boats and send them back to Europe?
It was, yes.
So why would the Continental Congress take on the immense, completely avoidable burden of marching, housing, and feeding thousands of enemy troops in the American wilderness? That sounds like a massive strategic blunder.
On the surface, it seems totally absurd, but it was actually a deeply cynical and brilliant strategic shell game orchestrated by the Continental Congress.
A shell game?
Yeah. They looked at the global board and realized that if they actually put those troops on boats and sent them home, King George wouldn't just let them retire to the countryside.
What would he do?
He would immediately use them to garrison forts across the British Empire, in Ireland, in England, in the Caribbean.
Oh, I see. Freeing up the fresh, healthy troops currently stationed at those forts to sail directly back to America and rejoin the fight.
Precisely the fear. Congress reneged on the signed deal specifically to keep those surrendered troops permanently locked off the global chessboard.
Wow. They essentially trapped them in a bureaucratic and physical limbo.
And the horrific, localized reality of that global shell game is that the Patriots had absolutely zero infrastructure to house them.
Right. Guards like Jacob Carwiles and the prisoners alike were just dumped into a freezing wilderness.
We're talking knee-deep snow, blinding blizzards, unfinished log cabins that didn't even have roofs yet.
And meager daily rations consisting of little more than corn cakes.
Throwing thousands of freezing, starving men into an unfinished camp in the woods is a recipe for the complete psychological collapse of social order.
And the records show that social order absolutely collapsed. But strangely, it happened mostly among the captors.
Yeah, this part is wild.
It reads like a bizarre Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
You have these freezing, starving, incredibly bored Patriot officers who managed to get their hands on what the local records call abominable local peach brandy.
And they consume this stuff and succumb to hallucinogenic, toxic violence.
They start turning on each other over totally imagined slights, fighting six or seven deadly duels in just a few days.
While Private Carwiles is just standing outside in the freezing snow, watching his own commanders drunkenly shoot at each other in the woods.
The bizarre juxtaposition between the guards and the prisoners is truly fascinating.
Because while the Patriot captors are collapsing into drunken anarchy and violence, the British and Hessian captives displayed an incredible level of psychological resilience.
Right. Amidst that freezing wilderness, the prisoners actually banded together and built a functioning mini-society.
They built a church in the camp.
And incredibly, they constructed an actual theater to entertain themselves. Right there in the snow.
They even took the time to paint a drop curtain featuring a Harlequin character looking out at the audience, holding a sign that asked, "Who would have expected all this here?"
The sheer absurdity of finding a functioning theater in a freezing POW camp in the Virginia wilderness perfectly captures the unpredictability of this war.
It does. It also brings up a vital mechanical question.
It is.
How does a captive army manage to build a church and a theater in a freezing forest? More broadly, how were the barracks, the prisons, and the bridges that kept the entire military machine running actually constructed when the army had so few resources?
Hearing that they built a theater makes me wonder about the actual invisible infrastructure of the war. Who is building this stuff?
This brings us to the literal builders of the conflict, men like Peter Valentine.
He was a carpenter from Westchester County, New York, right?
Yes, and his story completely shatters the standard military image for me.
Same here. When I picture a new recruit joining the Revolutionary War, I picture a guy grabbing a musket and joining a line.
But Valentine enlisted carrying his own personal tools, his own hammers, saws, and planes.
Why was he bringing his own gear? Didn't the military supply the engineers with what they needed?
The military simply couldn't. The Continental Army was painfully decentralized and severely underfunded by the Congress.
So they didn't have specialized units?
Nope. They possessed no standard professional engineering corps like modern militaries do. There were no massive warehouses of standardized equipment to hand out to recruits.
So they relied almost entirely on the pre-existing localized expertise and the personal physical equipment that the recruits brought with them from their civilian lives.
Exactly.
I always try to think of the 18th century army, not just as a bunch of guys with guns walking through fields, but as a massive moving city.
A moving city is the perfect way to conceptualize it.
Imagine a city that has to completely dismantle itself, cross unmapped, raging rivers, navigate steep mountain passes, and then physically rebuild itself from scratch every single night just so the inhabitants don't freeze to death.
And a city requires a massive, invisible support staff to function. The men with the muskets are only the very tip of the spear.
Valentine was doing the grueling, invisible labor. He was felling massive trees by hand, shaping greenwood, and building the vital load-bearing bridges that allowed the heavy artillery and the supply wagons to keep moving forward.
Think about the mechanics of that, building a bridge out of freshly cut wood over a freezing river while the army is waiting to cross.
Without men like Valentine properly framing roofs so soldiers didn't die of exposure in their sleep, or engineering river crossings so food and gunpowder could flow, the combat front lines would completely collapse in a matter of days.
The combat troops were entirely dependent on the speed of his saws and hammers.
The entire military apparatus was balanced on the shoulders of carpenters, blacksmiths, and laborers who rarely make it into the sweeping historical narratives.
So true.
So what does this all mean?
Well, this deep dive really forces us to completely redefine the word patriot.
It isn't just the stoic man standing in a perfectly straight line on a green field holding a flag. No.
Yeah.
The definition of a patriot has to expand to include Richard Waters, the sole surgeon covered in mud, fighting microscopic wars with a leather apron.
It has to include Aaron Powell, the escaped son-in-law, bearing the agonizing weight of loss back to his family.
It is Jacob Carwiles, the freezing guard, watching his commanders duel in the snow, and Peter Valentine, the carpenter covered in sawdust, building the moving city.
Recognizing that invisible machinery of survival is crucial, especially because that machinery hasn't disappeared from our world.
It really hasn't. It has merely changed form and updated its technology.
Just look around your own life.
Yeah, the invisible infrastructure holding the modern moving city together is still there. Think about the undocumented builders framing the roofs over our heads today.
Or the municipal sanitation workers who manage our water tables and keep the microscopic threats at bay.
Ensuring our modern cities don't become massive incubators like the camps of the 1770s.
Think about the unseen care workers pulling triple shifts in hospitals.
Or the people operating forklifts and stocking warehouse shelves at 3 a.m. to prevent our modern fragile supply chains from collapsing.
They're the invisible infrastructure, performing vital acts of daily endurance that keep the rest of us alive.
The uniforms change, the medical tools improve, but the absolute necessity of the work, the underlying physical architecture of society, remains exactly the same.
It really does.
And that leads me to one final provocative thought for you to mull over, building on how our main source, My Patriot Story, was actually compiled.
Right, because the DAR relied heavily on messy family lore, fading letters, and oral traditions passed down through generations.
It is inherently subjective. But in our modern era, We are clinically obsessed with objective historical accuracy.
Oh, absolutely. We demand the exact dates, the precise troop movements, the hard data.
The verified spreadsheets of history.
We constantly prioritize the macro-level data over the micro-level experience.
But does our reliance on that cold, objective data make us miss the deeper, truer point of what history actually is?
That's a great question to ask.
Think about it. If the horrific, visceral memory of Richard Waters' medical tent, or the profound emotional truth of Aaron Powell's agonizing walk home to his wife, shapes a family's resilience and identity for generations, does a blurred date or a missing tactical detail on a map even matter?
It forces us to ask if the messy, subjective, profoundly human memory is actually a much truer reflection of what war really is than any tactical map could ever be.
I think it just might be. The human experience is the history. So the next time you picture the Revolutionary War, I want you to remember that staggering 9-to-1 ratio.
Throw out the sanitized movie reel of the Stoic generals on the white horses.
Remember the mud, remember the blood streams, remember the lice and the wool, and remember the invisible infrastructure that built the moving city. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the hidden war. And as always, stay curious.